Hey, hockey heads, get ready for the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. Each game day, answer four questions. Pick the winning team, guess if points will be over or under, predict the first goal, and choose the highest scoring period. Daily winners snag gift cards, while each round's champs pocket cold, hard cash. Play now at games.dailyfaceoff.com and prove your puck prowess. It's fast, it's fun, and it's all about hockey. Let's go.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the DFO Rundown Podcast with Frank Saravalli and Jason Greger on dailyfaceoff.com. Delivered by DoorDash.
Welcome to episode 155 of the DFO Rundown. I'm Jason Greger alongside Frank Saravalli. Frank, how was your weekend?
It was good. Training camp week. Let's go.
Yes, the rookie tournaments are on, and training camp, the medicals on Wednesday. Teams will be on the ice on Thursday. And the big story over the weekend, well, there's two of them. One, of course, Blake Wheeler is no longer the captain in Winnipeg. And good timing for us because Rick Bowness, the head coach of the Jets, was booked. He'll be our guest today on the pod. So we'll get to up close and personal with the head coach on the Jets and, you know, where a team goes. I think that's a team that really felt like they underachieved last year. So now they come in, there'll be some changes there. And then, Frank, you also had the story about Evander Kane and the settlement with the San Jose Sharks. There's no cap penalty for the Sharks. It's retroactive. Kane gets a one lump sum payment, and now we move on. What were you surprised by this outcome, or is this what you expected?
Not surprised by the outcome because this is sort of along the lines of what they had been talking for the last number of months in that the Oilers were trying to structure their contract with Evander Kane going back to right before free agency based on the idea of making him whole for whatever he would settle with the Sharks. They just weren't able to make it happen in time in terms of a settlement. And they basically decided then, okay, we're going to sign this deal and we're thinking that there's going to be some kind of settlement that comes. We don't know what it'll look like, but they kind of did it in the reverse order. Instead of working with the Oilers and the Sharks to hammer it all out in June or July, they signed with the Oilers and then went back and the Sharks essentially said, okay, well, let's figure out what the difference is here and we'll try and make you whole based on the dollars that you're owed. What is surprising is that this is an unprecedented settlement in terms of how this is structured on the San Jose Sharks cap. There is zero cap penalty. Evander Kane, we believe, is getting a lump sum payment in the range of $2.5 million. He's going to make $16.5 million in the first 3 years of his deal with the Oilers. He was owed 19 over the last 3 years of his deal with the Sharks. The difference there is that $2.5 million. And instead of taking that money and dividing it over 3 years and hitting the Sharks with a cap hit, instead, the settlement calls for that entire $2.5 million penalty to be applied retroactively to the San Jose Sharks cap last season. And so since they ended with $4.97 million in cap space, that penalty just chews up a bit of that unused space that was going to waste anyway, and there's no future consequence for the San Jose Sharks. I can tell you that there's a number of teams around the NHL, Jason, that raised the side eyebrow at that, saying, really? Like, that's the only penalty that they're going to have here? Why is the NHL okay with this? And the best answer that I can surmise from that is The NHL is okay with it because they deem this to be a satisfactory contract termination based on the details that they were provided last January when the contract was terminated anyway. So the league was on board with the Sharks doing it then. Clearly, they wouldn't want to penalize the Sharks moving forward now for something that they believe they were in their full rights to do.
Yeah, which I wonder if that opens Pandora's box, because no one really knows what the reasoning was and why they did why they deemed him that you know, you could terminate his contract, because it was proven, you know, there is the him illegally crossing the border. Well, that was proven false. So, you know, it came down to some things that happened, you know, in the room inside the organization that they didn't like. And I just wonder, though, if other teams look at this and say, hey, now you have a precedent for us if we want to terminate a contract. Now, it's different because Kane was playing great. That's the thing. I think it would probably raise an eyebrow if you have a player who's a high cap hit and he's not producing. Kane was their leading scorer the year before, right? He was one of their best players.
Well, go back to the last high-profile contract termination that was fought back in 2015 with Mike Richards and the LA Kings. The big reason why the Kings ended up with a long-term penalty, Richards is on their cap until 2032. This year, it's $900,000 is the penalty, which is more than the league minimum player. You got to go back to the way that Richards was playing at the time. He had already been sent to the AHL. Yeah. His game had fallen off of a cliff, and they weren't happy with him and wanted to try and find a way to wiggle out of the contract. And now I'm sure that there's all sorts of language in this contract settlement that says that this is not precedent setting. But if you're a team that's sitting there that has a player that's either problematic for you or problematic on your cap, I'd have to think that you're looking at this saying that's it. That's all they had to deal with. Let's try it. And in the very worst case scenario, we settle for something that's a lot less than what's currently on our cap. I'd have to be thinking long and hard about that if I was running a team and I was in a dealing with a contract, either with a problem player or someone that's really damaging to my cap. It's not fair. It's not nice, but you know, that's the way things work in business and in the NHL.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Now, before we get to more, let's get to Rick Bowness, the head coach of the Jets, and then we'll figure other things out because that's obviously a huge story.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Our next guest has been behind an NHL bench since 1984. He's the only man actively to have also coached in the 1980s, still spanning a bunch of decades later. And he is now in his second turn as head coach of the Winnipeg Jets, the only man to be head coach in both iterations, Jets 1.0 and 2.0. The DFO Rundown is pleased to welcome Rick Bowness to the podcast. Rick, how you doing?
Doing great, thank you. And just so you know, I know what the league says about 1984. Actually, I came here in November of 1983 as an assistant coach. I know that's what the NHL record book says. I've been after the change, but they fired Tommy Watt in November of 1983. They brought in Barry Long as coach, and I was a player assistant coach for the American League team at that point. I was 28 years old. They asked me to retire and come up and join the coaching staff. So I did. So, and here we are. And my first stint here was in 89. That was on an interim basis, just to wipe up the season. So much more comfortable coming in here now in terms of both those other situations, far more comfortable coming in here this year.
That is an important correction, and we'll have to get on Hockey TV to make those corrections.
You know, who cares about that? Probably nobody.
No, but I think that's great. Like, I love that you pointed it out, so we'll have to get on that. Rick, you mentioned your comfort in coming in this time around with the Winnipeg Jets, and it's interesting because last week, a little bit of stir, maybe some discomfort created, and maybe that'll work out well for the Jets. In the end, the announcement made that Blake Wheeler will no longer continue as team captain. Can you just let us in on a little bit of why you felt like the time was right now to make a change with leadership and to bring in more people into the leadership group?
A couple of reasons for that. First of all, it's changes. We've changed the whole coaching staff. And so there's changes there. There's changes to how we do things as opposed to the staff that was here prior to us coming in here. There's going to be changes to the way we play. We want to become a lot more aggressive hockey team than what happened here last year. This team is a good hockey team. It just lost its way a little bit. And that happens every sport, every professional team. You have a year, things just don't go your way. So all these changes have been made. And right, and now is a good time to take a look at the leadership group of the team and make some changes with that. You have to. They missed the playoffs. So we have to make some changes. They can't coaching style of play. I mean, we've got to make as many changes as we can to make sure we turn things around here. And it affects the leadership group. Blake's a huge part of the leadership group still. Just won't have a C or an A. He's the most experienced guy we've had. And don't lose sight of the fact he's still a hell of a hockey player. And he's bought in. He's accepted this. But again, there's time in every organization's growth. And we went through it in Dallas recently with Rupe Hintz and Miro and those guys, that they have to step up and take more responsibility for the product on the ice and what goes on off the ice. So what we're trying to do here is just open up that door for those younger guys, not just younger guys, but everyone in that room, take more responsibility of what's going on here. And because ultimately it comes down to the players playing hard, playing together. But the X and O's and all that, they don't work until you get everyone bought into the team culture. And we need more guys helping out with that. It can't be on one guy. Blake, every night after a loss here, he's the guy that has to step up and deal with the media and the fans and everything. We want more people to accept that responsibility. Basically, it's all in. So that's an all-encompassed answer to your question, but it's not as simple as we just want to change the leadership. There's a lot more involved to it than that.
Mm-hmm. Not to downplay anything that Blake might be feeling. I'm sure it stung. He mentioned that it was a surprise. But do we in the media, you've been around, we mentioned your resume, like, do we make too big a deal of who's captain and who isn't?
Well, you guys have jobs to do. So, right, we all have to work together and closely and make it work. We all have jobs to do. And I've said this before, that some of the best leaders I've coached, some of the best leaders I played with, they never had a C or an A. If you're going to lead, you're going to lead. You shouldn't have to rely on, okay, I'm wearing an A or a C, I can do this. Leadership comes from the heart. It comes from your passion for the game, your love of your teammates, your care of your team. You can't let a letter dictate that passion, that love, that caring. So do we expect other guys who aren't wearing an A to step up? Absolutely we do. It's not just going to be on the guys wearing the A's. It's not. We want more guys to step up. So I know we can't let, sometimes you can hide. Well, I can't say that I'm not wearing an A. Well, yeah, you got something to say, you say it. And that's what we're trying to do, is open it. Just get a far more open communication within the room.
Rick, you were a head coach in the National Hockey League in the early 90s. And then for 20 years, you were an assistant or an associate coach, and then returned to a head coach. Do you have that philosophy of you say anything, it doesn't matter? How does that work from being an assistant or an associate coach instead of the head coach, if we want to use like the C or A analogy? Did you see a comparison there where sometimes when you were the associate or the assistant, you know, you might have to say something that normally the head coach would say?
Well, I would say, yeah, I did. I mean, unfortunately, when I was the assistant or the associate, the head coaches always gave me the green light. You got something to say, step up there. But I was also working behind the scenes with the other players saying, okay, you know, you're not wearing an A, but you know what? My conversations with the players are huge. You get a lot of feedback. So even in those situations, when I was the assistant or the associate, and a player would talk to me, I said, that's important you talk to your teammates about that, not just me. And it's better coming from you than it is coming from me. So I was always encouraging anybody that I coached over the years, if they had something to say that was constructive, that would help the room, that would help the team, regardless if they wore a C or an A, they were encouraged to speak up. And that's how you get more people involved in the room. They can't be afraid or are hesitant. Maybe the phrase too strong. They can't be hesitant to speak up when they think they've got something to say. Now, it doesn't mean everyone's always going to agree with it, but it's open for, then you have more discussion. And that's what you want. You want the guys talking about it in the room.
Rick, in one essence, you're kind of the Gordie Howe of coaching. It's 5 decades now that you're spanning your coaching career. And so when you think about like a young Rick Bonus, you know, coaching guys in the 80s and then the 90s and the 2000s and so much has changed overall. And you have this reputation, I mean, this great players coach. How are you able to still connect with guys when you think about it, like, you know, 4 to 5 different decades of young players coming in, and everybody says today's athlete is that much different. You've coached it all. You've experienced it. Is it that much different? And how have you been able to connect with kids? And in some age, are you know, 45 years younger than you.
Well, when I came here in 83, I was 28 years old. I was younger than some of the players. And now I'm old enough to be their grandfather. So that's the reality of it. When I got into coaching, I just remember playing and going to a coach who I wasn't playing much. Give me, you know, what can I do? I want to play more, work harder. Well, I'm working. That's all I've got is a work ethic. So I said to myself then, if you ever get into coaching, communication with your players is absolutely huge for me. I always wanted to have a good rapport with my coach. And I always said, when I get into coaching, I've got to make sure that we have those conversations. And sometimes they're all very tough, hard conversations, but you can't be afraid to have them. And so one of the things I've always prided myself in is my ability to talk to the players. And yeah, everything has changed. The way we coach, the technology of the way we present things, everything about our game has changed other than the basic fundamentals, the basic principles of how the game should be played have not changed. It's up to the coach to adapt to that. That line in Moneyball where Brad Pitt's firing or talking to the head scout, they're like adapt or die. And that's kind of, I guess, kind of how I've just survived. But I've always been a big communicator. And probably cost me a job or two down the road because that was early, like, well, you're too nice or you're too this or you're too that. And first of all, you call me a player's coach. I'm not into labels. I'm not into, oh, he's a defensive coach, player's coach, not a player. I just kind of completely ignore all that stuff. You do what you have to do is the way I coach. And big part of it, you do have to communicate with your players. But more so today, they're very well educated coming into the game in terms of nutrition and off-ice conditioning. training and different systems. They're far more educated now than they were 15, 20 years ago, which speaks highly of the coaches that they're playing with as they're coming through minor hockey and junior or college or European, however they get here. So you have to be able to communicate with them. They've had good coaching. They want to know why far more now. And they want explanations on how the whole thing just kind of ties together. And it's up to the coach to be able to relate to the players exactly what you're feeling. So to answer your question, again, I know long-winded, you have to be able to communicate with every generation that comes up. I've raised three kids right now. So now I'm a grandfather. Raising my kids helped me through those generations, talking to them. That helped me. So then you get to the stage in life, man, you just enjoy every day, work with the players every day, talk to them, have some fun with them, get to know them.
Love that. Clearly the communication comes easy to you, Rick. You spent the last 5 years in Dallas, including parts of the last three as head coach, taking the Stars to the final there in the bubble in 2020. There was some talk that you might retire last year. What drew you to Winnipeg?
Well, I had some, we had some different options. Not as head coach, but just back to the assistant associate role to come in. I looked at the teams. They were all rebuilding. I'm at the stage of my career where I want to go through a rebuild. I thought the Winnipeg scenario attracted me because it is a good hockey club. And my wife Judy and I were talking, if we get back into it, we want to make sure we're working with really, really good people. I've had the fortune of doing that wherever I've been. And this is a great staff. Mark Chipman's a great owner with Chevy and Zinger and Larry Simmons, wonderful people to work with. I've been able to hire a great staff and Scott O'Neill, Brad Lauer, Marty Johnson, Wade Flaherty was here. So I'm surrounded by great people. So from a coaching perspective, you want to come to the rink every day. You want to be surrounded with good people. I am. I looked at the team. Yeah, they lost their way a little bit last year. Can we come in there and help them get back on track? I guess it was that challenge that brought me back. And when I went to Dallas, I only went there on a 1-year contract. And so I said then, well, you know what? At the end of this year, we'll reevaluate again. Do we want to keep going here? And we had a good time in Dallas. So it worked out okay. But the attraction here was the people, the ownership, the management, the coaching staff we were able to put together, talking to a lot of the players over the summer. They're good people here. And so when you come, I love waking up in the morning. Well, I can't wait to get to the rink. And work with these guys, talk to somebody. And I always tell Judy, when I wake up and I look at you and I say, I really don't want to go today, you give me a shot, because that's the first sign of retirement right there. We haven't hit that yet.
That's awesome. So when you think about the challenge of this Winnipeg team and getting them back on track and into the playoffs, as you're sitting there this summer, you know, thinking about the team, the roster, maybe jotting down whatever you do on the back of a cocktail napkin, line combinations, or thinking about how this team is going to be a little bit different, what do you see? How did the Jets get there?
It would be a beer napkin, not a cocktail napkin.
Okay, there you go. What's your beer of choice?
Well, you look at the core of the team, it's got a great young goaltender and Connor Hellebuyck. Everything starts there. Goaltending is the most important position in sports to me. You have a bad goalie, you could play fantastic in front of him, you're going to lose. You have a great goalie, you can have a bad game here and there, he's going to win the game. So we've got a great young goaltender in Connor. We've got a good mobile defense. We've got some great young forwards up, you know, Scheifele, you know, Dubois coming into his own, Connor. So it's that, and Nikolai Ehlers. I mean, they're good young players, so we can score. The defense is mobile. Morrissey's a hell of a player. Pionk, like Dylan, we got good pieces. That's the attraction. We think, and that's to pull this thing, that we can pull this thing back together. We can get us back in the right direction, and then we'll see what happens. But you have to have the pieces, and we believe we have those pieces.
Rick, I've always wanted to ask you this. I love that you clarified the start of your coaching career. In 1991-92, you were the head coach of the Boston Bruins. You guys went to the conference finals. That was the year I think you acquired Adam Oates midway through the season. Then the next year, you're the head coach of the Ottawa Senators, an expansion team. What happened that summer in Boston to leave the Bruins to go to Ottawa?
Well, yeah, that's a long time ago. I know now, but that was the first time I had been fired, and it was definitely shocking. We thought we had a great year. Exactly. I remember going in to think we're going to talk about an extension because I don't have a 2-year contract, and all of a sudden we're walking out the door. I think a lot of it, I was a different personality that came in there. Terry O'Reilly was there and a great coach. Mike Milbury was there, longtime Bruins. Everyone knew who they were. Big, tough, physical Bruins, the way the Bruins played for years. I came in and really as an unknown, right? I was. We had great success. There's no question about it. St. Louis fired Brian Sutter at that point. My understanding was that Harry had always, Brian Sutter was a typical, the way the Bruins played back then, fight everybody, be physical. And I think when Brian became available, they wanted to bring him in as coach. I think it's as simple as that. And again, I was different personality than Mike and Terry. And I was more of a talker, more of a communicator, more of a get feedback from the players, all that. That was different than was being coached back then. And I said earlier, that probably cost me some jobs, but that's probably what, there's probably a really good example.
Okay. Well, the adage, though, the nice guys always finish last isn't true, because you've been coaching now for numerous years and you've had that, maybe more of a positive guy. Now, we've seen you, like anybody, can lose his temper at times. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's kind of, I don't know, maybe it's not funny for you, but we never see, we always see Rick as this really happy, fun-loving guy. And so when we see Rick finally lose it, it's like, do you chuckle afterwards? Like, how are you being so patient that you've only had a few blow-ups as a coach over your time, at least public ones?
I've had a few more than you realize behind closed doors, where I like to keep it. Passion is passion. And I think that the energy and passion has driven me all these years. I'm not sitting here saying I'm the smartest coach ever. I'm not. I get that. But one thing I try to do every day is bring a positive attitude, bring energy, bring passion, and keep it under control. Sometimes it gets a little bit out of control, but that's coming from the heart. So there's been a few more blowups than you realize. I guess it's just the heat of the moment. And sometimes you get a little bit too wrapped up as a coach back there. You try not to, but there's times where you feel your bench needs it, or your team needs to hear that you're behind them, or they need a good boost. And you just got to let the heart and the passion come out.
All right, Rick, let's play a little rapid fire.
All right, Rick, the only rules in rapid fire is you have to answer the question. Okay. All right. We'll start with some easy ones. What is your what's your beer of choice?
Bud Light.
Ooh, Bud Light. All right. When you were an associate coach, you're a really fun guy. Who is your favorite head coach that you like to prank?
Alain.
Why?
Alain Vigneault. Because he and I had a history. I had hired him in Ottawa as an assistant, and our roles had changed. So I always had a good rapport with Alain.
Thing that impresses you most about Miro Heiskanen's game?
That he wants to be out there. He wants the ball. The game's on the line. Miro wants to be on the ice. As an 18-year-old, he came in. And if it was a one-goal lead, he wanted to be on the ice. If we needed a goalie, he wanted to be on the ice. Some guys get nervous and they get out there and they want to be out there for 20, 25 seconds to get off. Miro, you'd have to pull him off the ice. I love the fact that he wants the ball and go with it.
So can you sense that in a player early, Rick? And then if guys you feel are taking short shifts, do you talk about them to say, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, you deal with it right away. I mean, you can see that in players. So you just got to watch them. And you just watch Miro coming in as a rookie. And man, he wanted to be out there like right away. There's a tremendous amount of poise in a player that wants to be out there, a tremendous amount of confidence, and a tremendous amount of will. Miro has all of that. And you can also tell, okay, this guy's, he's a little nervous out there. The shift is shorter. He's cautious and you're sitting back too much. So then you got to deal with that. Like, we want you on the ice, but you've got to get a lot more assertive. You got to show you want to be out there. So it's the player's reaction that you're coaching off of.
Now, Rick, you clarified something, so I want to make sure this is right. It's listed in 82-83 with the Sherbrooke Jets that you were the player head coach. Were you, in fact, the head coach, Reg Dunlop, a.k.a. Rick Bowness? And what was the toughest part of being a head coach and player at the same time?
Yes, I was player head coach. The coach that we were going into Sherbrooke after leaving Tulsa in the Central League. We were going into Quebec. They had hired Ron Rousset, who was a very popular and accomplished junior coach in the Quebec League. Unfortunately, Ron had a brain tumor removed in July, was unable to start the season. They asked me as a captain, kind of older guy, to take over and be player coach for until Christmas. I said, sure, I'll give that a bit. So even take it back a little further, what was the last player coach contract I signed with John Ferguson Sr. We had a clause in there that he wanted me to get into coaching when my playing days were over. It came a lot earlier than either one of us expected. But so there was that, we had already initiated that conversation about when I was finished playing, I would get into coaching with the organization. It came a lot quicker. But anyway, so they asked me, just do it for till Christmas. Ron will be back at Christmas. And unfortunately, Ron couldn't come back. So I finished the year. The hard part, I had Ron Wilson on the team. He was up and down a lot. The hard part was when, okay, and I'd have to tell Ron, okay, Ron, I'm going on the ice now. Make sure these guys are ready to go. And I always stood behind the bench. I'd come off the ice and I'd be tired, but I'd stand behind the bench. And in Sherbrooke, our bench was here. The penalty box was right here beside it.
Yeah.
And the other bench was across. So when I'd get a penalty, I'd be coaching from the penalty box and I'd be talking to the guys. And the referee came over because the other coach complained. He's yelling and screaming at me. You can't do that. And I said to him, well, you show me in the rule book where I can't coach from the penalty box, right? There's no such rule. So the hard part was that in the penalty box, trying to coach, especially when we're on the road and we didn't have the box right beside sinus and just coming off the ice. And I didn't play. I benched myself an awful lot. And because, okay, coach going on the power play. Well, I wasn't a power play guy. So I didn't change that. So that was the hardest part, but it was a tremendous learning experience. Tom Watt was coaching here in Winnipeg at the time. And I was on the phone with him quite a bit and he helped me through it an awful lot.
Dude, that's taking coaching your kid to a new level, coaching yourself. I absolutely love it.
Hey, I was honest, man. I knew I wasn't that great a player. So
now, you were a point-of-game player. I looked up your AHL stats, man. You were a point-of-game player. And if you weren't a power play guy, then that's pretty good.
Oh, God. That'd be pretty bad, eh? You're a head coach and you're putting yourself on the first power play unit for a minute and a half.
Love it.
You've coached a lot. You've been a penalty kill, power play, offense, forwards, defense. What specialty do you like best?
I like working with the young D and the young players more than anything. I just like enjoy the young players. You forward defense. I was coaching the defense for a long time in the league, and I really enjoyed that. Running the penalty kill. You could just build. You had a lot more time just with that smaller group of 6, 7, 8 defense, and you could build a really strong rapport with all of them. And I enjoyed that. But I've always enjoyed working with young players. And to me, at this stage in my career, in my life, like having an impact on them, not just on the ice, but off the ice, helping them grow as a person, as a man, as a husband, that's just as important to me as anything. The impact you can have on these young players there's a lot of guys that don't like you, but the guys that you do get along with, you feel you can have an impact on them on and off the ice. That's what kind of motivates me as well. If I don't win a Stanley Cup, I don't win a Stanley Cup. It's not the end of the world. When I leave, I'm hoping that I've had an impact on players' lives.
Oh, it's well said, Rick. That's fantastic. One last one then, so you relate to them. Do you have TikTok, Twitter, or Instagram?
None of the above, and have absolutely zero. I never look at it, and I tell my kids, don't tell me. I don't want to know anything about it, because my daughter works for the National Predators. Ryan is now the assistant general manager in Ottawa at the Senators. My daughter-in-law is the vice president of suite and ticket sales for the Colorado Avalanche. They can deal with all those things. I don't want to touch any of it.
Wow, that's a big fam. You guys are covering all the divisions. I like it.
Yeah, Rick, I'd say we're all like three of us in one division here. I know Ryan. Oh,
that'll be good. Ryan, Mom's going to – who's she cheering for, though? Your wife. She'll be tough-pressed. That's who she's cheering for.
50-50 when we're playing those teams.
Rick, thanks so much for joining us and continued success in what's been an unbelievable career in the NHL.
Appreciate it very much. Always a pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Rick Bowness, always a good character, man, as he had quite the career. And hey, I kind of like it, Frank. He comes in and hey, I guess you get everybody's attention. Maybe you take some pressure off some people. There's some uncomfortable stuff. Who knows? But you know, you had said at the end of last season that the Jets, there was, I don't know if dysfunction might be too harsh of a word, but there was just a lot going on in that team. And you know,
dissatisfaction is fair.
Yeah, that's fair. So maybe removing the C, maybe take some pressure off Blake Wheeler. At the same time, maybe it forces some other guys to say, hey, I got to step up here. We got to get everybody pulling the boat in the right direction. So I'm more intrigued. The Jets were one of the teams. I know you had them as your cup winner last year. Obviously, they were disappointing across the league. I'm really kind of curious to see what the change now with Rick coming in as the head coach and this whole captaincy and what it's going to mean for the Jets.
I think we probably tend to overrate captains in general.
Fair. I would agree on that.
I think there's so much focus and pressure put on that player that it's probably unfair. And more often than not, it doesn't mean as much. And not to say there's not honor in the position. Of course there is. It's a nice feather in your cap. And Blake Wheeler spoke last week about that exact idea that there was nothing more that he wanted in the league and that it was something that he took a lot of pride in. But at the same time, we've seen other players be stripped of their captaincy previously. Joe Thornton in San Jose, Dustin Brown, LA. I mean, those guys hung around those teams for a long time after the fact, and the team still achieved success to a relative point after the fact as well. So as dramatic as it may seem, it's almost like one of those things where you cut the cord and things probably go back to somewhat normal. I would imagine that, you know, Blake Wheeler recognizes that it's not exactly the same part of his routine and his jersey may look a little different to start the year, but I mean, at the end of the day, you show up and you play, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Now, speaking of showing up and playing, we've talked about some UFA guys, but there are some interesting RFAs that are property of teams, Frank, that have yet to sign. Let's start with Rasmus Sandin in Toronto. He's a young defenseman. You know, people are high on him. The Leafs, like a lot of teams, don't have a bunch of cap space. And, you know, RFAs without Arbrights, Frank, it's one of the rare times where teams can kind of flex their muscles. And I think that's going to happen here. But if you're a young player like Sandin, I think if you're the Leafs and you're him, you want him in camp on the ice on Thursday.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt you'd like to see him continue his push on your blue line. And I think when you look at the way the table was set further this week, like I think heading into the summer, we had a really good idea of what the Rasmus Sandin contract would look like for the Leafs, because Timothy Liljegren signed that 2-year deal at $1.4 million a year. And he's coming off of a 23-point season and 61 games. And he's a guy that, you know, wasn't able to really push and crack the lineup for all 7 games of that first round series. Sandin, right around the same age, Sandin was a first round pick and obviously a really talented guy. He played 51 games last year. Again, with the injury and what he went through, couldn't make it into the lineup in the playoffs. And then you have a table setter with Sean Durzi from the LA Kings that signed late last week to get himself into camp on time with the Kings. And that's a 2-year deal at 1.7. So you have Liljegren 2-year deal at 1.4, Durzi 2-year deal at 1.7. My guess is that Sandin comes in right around the same neighborhood as Liljegren, maybe even a little bit less. Does he split the difference between those two guys? I don't know what leverage he would have in order to get into that category, because you know, you look at Sean Durzi and the impact that he had on the Kings really right from Jump Street, coming in at a time when they had a ton of injuries in their lineup and was a force for that team and great in the playoffs, really good in that series against the Oilers in the first round. 27 points for Durzi in just 64 games. Like, Sandin doesn't have that on his resume. I, I don't think he's reaching that high, but I know the ask has been that high. So it's been higher, I believe, than that. We'll see where it ends up. I just don't see Sandin having the leverage.
Well, really, the challenge for the Leafs is, you know, now you look at their roster and Sandin would be kind of what most people assume, one of their top seven defensemen. Mm-hmm. But if you look right now with two goalies, 14 forwards and 60 at $22 million, they're over the cap. So even if you sign him for whatever, 900,000, 950, a million, you know, they're still over. And then they also brought in Zach Aston-Reese, a guy that they're very high on, who now he could sign a contract, maybe similar cash to guys like Joey Anderson or Adam Gaudette or Kyle Clifford. And it would just be a change out. One guy goes to the minors, but you know, Toronto, like a few other teams are so tight against the cap. I'm curious how they're going to fit him in. I think they could sign him. It's more so how do you fit them in on the roster? Like there's some teams here that are going to have some interesting cap juggling, Frank, leading up to the start of the regular season to get under the cap.
And they've still got guys that they're trying to, you know, fit in. Zach Aston-Reese is another guy that my guess is probably going to win a contract. I do think they've been dealing with a little bit of an injury up front. I think Pierre Engvall has been a little bit banged up this summer and may miss a little bit of time. So that would be one way to manage their cap a little bit is if Engvall is out, but it doesn't, all it does is kick the can down the road.
Yeah, it just delays it until he has to come off.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I guess my thing is, I don't know where Sandin has leverage. And I think that's always what you're trying to find in any sort of contract negotiation is find the leverage point and squeeze it. And I just don't know that it's overwhelming in his corner.
No. Oh, 100%. Very, very few of them have it. Now, the one guy who you would think could have some leverage because he's so productive is Jason Robertson. Is now he's a bigger ticket.
He's got friend. Leverage.
Yeah, he's definitely got some leverage. And you know, you look at the Dallas Stars right now, and people would say, well, the Stars have a lot of cap space. They got about 6.3 mil. But I think Jason Robertson looks at a lot of these contracts that have been signed and says, hey, I should be in the $8 million range when you look at, you know, Thomas and Tkachuk and Norris and all these other players, and he's outperformed them. Like all of the precedent says Robertson should be an $8 million player with the recent signings this summer.
Yeah, I mean, I could see him since he touched 41 goals and nearly 80 points. Like I could see you making the case if you're his agent and Pat Brisson saying, this is a $9 million player.
Yeah.
Because we know the cap's going up and we know that if he's signing long-term, you don't want to be in a spot where, not to say that at $9 million, you're going to be vastly underpaid, but we don't know what the cap's going to look like in 4 years. $9 million might look like a bargain if a guy's, you know, who knows what kind of leap he can continue to take in his game. Can he get to 100 points? I mean, he's still just a young guy at age 23. I think you don't want to leave a lot of money on the table and end up coming back and having the same sort of feelings that Nathan MacKinnon had. Not to say he's in the same category, but he's a guy that really took a ginormous leap last year going from 45 to 79 points. What if he has another push in that vein next 2 years?
Now, the one interesting thing about Dallas is Anton Khudobin, Frank, because if he's on LTI, that would give them 6.4 in cap plus the 3.3, and that would put them up to 9.7.
And what I think that is the expectation that he is probably not ready to play.
Okay, so if he's not ready, then you know the Stars do have the money to get it done. And when you look at historically, players who hold out, and if it goes long, playing catch up in the NHL is a very risky proposition and very few have success. I think to benefit the Stars and Robertson, they'd be better off to get now more so the Stars, because as we saw with Nylander a few years ago in Toronto, right? Remember he held out, he got his money. And then that rest of that year of his the first year of his deal, it wasn't very productive. Now he's lived up to it since then, but trying to play catch up in the NHL, Frank, is very difficult even for good players.
I would tend to agree, and I would place probably even more of an emphasis on it for Jason Robertson, because I have no idea what his training has been like since. Clearly, he took a huge leap in his game, but Mike McKenna tells the story and has told it previously on the Daily Faceoff show. He was in Texas in the AHL when Jason Robertson first got assigned there, and they had to send him home because he wasn't in proper shape. So, you know, this is a guy that I would imagine you'd want to get in as early as possible.
Yeah. And another guy who doesn't get a lot of talk, maybe league wide, Frank, Nicholas Hägg, the defenseman in Vegas, He's a really good young defenseman. And you know what? Vegas is a team that obviously wants to bounce back after a difficult season. They've got some question marks in goal with the injury to Robin Lehner. I look at them
in cap jail.
Yeah, well, they're in cap jail for sure, but they're going to have a lot of guys on LTIR, right? And Shea Weber and Lehner, they're, what is that between the two of them?
12,
like, almost 13, almost 13 mil, right? So I think if, you know, that does give him the space, but Hague again, doesn't have enough, doesn't have much negotiating power. I think he has more than, you know, even a guy like Sandin for sure. But I think Nick Hague is, I think he's a top four defenseman in Vegas, and they need him in camp, and he, as a young player, needs to be in there. So he's another guy to watch for. And Vegas, that whole team, Frank, like, I don't, on paper, they got some talent, but man, they got some question marks in goal. I'm fascinated to see how Vegas does in the first 2 months of the season.
Yeah. So, like, how different is Hague than these other guys that we've been talking about in terms of AAV?
Like, oh, yeah. It's not, he's not that much
negotiating power. Right in that same sort of world. Like, you would think that at a certain point, unless the Golden Knights are trying to, you know, squeeze out a longer term deal, and they found some success with that. Like, think back to the deal that Zach Whitecloud signed, 6 years times 2.75. They've gotten some guys on some value contracts signed longer term. Keegan Kolesar is another one, 3 times 1.4. Nicolas Waugh, they had this summer. He was a high profile RFA. He signed 5 times $3 million. So, you know, they've tended to go longer term as part of their structure and their, the way they'd like to do things. But I don't, you know, I would think with some of those other guys that we just talked about, Liljegren, Durzi, some others, like, he's probably right in that world right now on a 2-year deal.
Yeah. And then there's two in Ottawa and Edmonton, Ryan McLeod in Edmonton, Alex Formanton in Ottawa. Ryan McLeod, basically his two options, if Edmonton can make a deal before Wednesday, which I think is unlikely, then he might be able to get a multi-year deal at like 1.1. If not, he's probably going to have to sign for a one-year deal around 900K.
Why do you say that?
Well, just because of their cap space situation, right?
Why before Wednesday, though?
Well, that's because they want him on the ice. For first day of training of camp, right?
Like, they wouldn't want to sign him to a longer term deal after Wednesday.
Well, I don't think they can risk even him being $210,000 more on the cap this year, right? Like, they are so, I've crunched all the numbers, they're so tight against the cap, Frank. It's kind of ridiculous. It's just more so for cap flexibility for the upcoming season.
Interesting.
Yeah, like they right now they might be able to squeeze a 21-man roster. And with that, I don't even know if that would have, you know, ultimately their best lineup. They might have to waive a one-way contract to get that under, right?
They're still trying to trade Jesse Puljujärvi. There's, even at this point in September, they're still trying to move him.
Yeah, well, I don't discount that. But I also wonder, Frank, if they're like, you know what, hey, get him in camp. They'll play him with McLeod and Fogel on a third line and see what, if anything, maybe an injury on another team in preseason, right? Like, I'm sure teams think about that right now, because realistically, though, I'm with you. I think if you're trading Puljujärvi, and the Order fans who love Puljujärvi won't like it, and I understand it, you might get a second round pick for him, which, you know, they'll look and say, well, hey, that's not great value, right? Because the second round pick, the only thing the second round pick helps them for is it gives the GM some trade capital at the deadline, right? Because Edmonton should be in buyer mode for the next few trade deadlines.
Well, I think you also want to be in a spot where you're accruing cap space in preparation for the deadline, right?
Well, that would help 100%, because they're one of many 10 teams that might start in LTI. So you almost can't accrue any space. That's their issue.
Okay. So it would be Klefbom on LTIR, right? So
and Mike Smith.
And Mike Smith, right.
Yeah, they got 6.2. So, and then Formanton in Ottawa, they've signed all their young guys, right? Now, he's not in the same category, of course, as Norris or Stützle or any of those guys, but you know, Alex Formanton, are you surprised he hasn't signed in Ottawa, considering that everybody else has?
A little bit. Pretty talented player. 32 points last year, knocking on the door of 20 goals, and someone that I would think is only going to continue to get better at age 23. I viewed the signing of Tyler Mott last week at 1.35, which, by the way, riled up the Vancouver fan base. You know, they were saying, well, at 1.35, should we just have brought this player back? He had made everyone around him better. I viewed Mott as insurance for Formanton. A player with some sandpaper and ability to make some things happen.
Now, Formanton's one of the few players from that World Junior team who hasn't made a public statement. Is there anything at play with that?
I don't want to read into that or even guess or speculate. I don't think that's fair. Clearly, I will say unrelated to Formanton, though, like this is coming to a head. The NHL wanted to have this investigation done before training camps opened. That's not going to be possible. But at some point in the near future, I'd say, you know, 30 to 45 days, there will be the completion of this NHL investigation. And that's concurrently happening at the same time as some other police investigations are happening because London reopened the investigation. That my guess is they're going to be sharing information, or at least the NHL will know at a certain point what the London investigation has produced, and that'll be part of the process as well. So whoever was involved, and again, I'm not speculating at all. I don't know the answer fully. And I, you know, there's a lot that goes into this, so we'll see. But is that related? All we know is he played on the team. Are the Sens one of those teams that's now sitting here saying, why would we give a contract to a player that could potentially have been involved? I don't know. I think that's unfair to speculate.
Yeah. Now here we are a few days away, from the opening of camp. What are your two most interesting storylines that you will be watching the first week of training camp? Medicals Wednesday, on the ice Thursday.
Preseason game Saturday.
Yes. That's early.
I don't know that there's any really burning questions. Nothing's really jumping out at me. What do you got?
I'm curious who's going to be the second line center in Colorado. They're the defending Stanley Cup champs, right? Like they got a really good team. I'm just curious who's going to be their second line center.
Who do you think it's going to be?
I don't know. Like you could run Landeskog and MacKinnon if you wanted, right? It's probably a little bit unorthodox maybe for them, but you know, they don't, honestly, I don't.
My guess is it's Evan Rodriguez.
JT Compher is going to get a chance. Yeah, JT Compher was the one guy I thought. Like JT Compher, I really liked his playoffs.
That's going to be the battle, I guess, is between Rodriguez and Compher.
Yeah. And so he would, that's the interesting.
That is a very specific position. That is a very NFL-like training camp positional battle that I did not see coming from you.
No, well, we don't have a lot of those. You know what I mean? Like if most teams, you could look and say, okay, are there any real significant positions that are up for grabs? And I'm talking like a competitive team. Like it's just rare.
I mean, Toronto and the goalie situation is interesting. Matt Murray, Ilya Samsonov, who's the opening night starter? Who gets the bulk of the games? Matt Murray is making, I don't know, almost three times more. He'll clearly get an opportunity, but if I were to be placing a bet, and I don't know what kind of odds I would get, my guess would, I'd put my money on Samsonov.
To be this, see, I think what they, you know, the cap hit and everything, I think Murray gets opening night. I think there might be some politics in there or just, you know, optics. But then after that, Frank, I think it's wide open. I agree with you. Like and they might want that. Like a 40-40 split might not be the worst thing for them at all. If it means both are playing okay, then it's fine, right? You don't necessarily, you know, unless you have a Vasilevsky or Shesterkin type of starter, do you need your starter to play 55 games unless they're clearly better than your backup?
No, you don't. Another positional, it's actually not positional at all. I'm curious to see the impact of John Tortorella on the Flyers.
Oh, yeah. You know,
those comments from a few weeks back when he said there's a problem in our room or there might be, like that captured my attention. And what does that mean? And what does he know? And how does he fix it? And it's like, it feels like that training camp for the Flyers is going to be blood sport.
Man, how many guys have been on speed dial with Cam Atkinson to figure out, you know, how to deal with torts?
And will it matter?
Yeah.
Will it matter at the end of the day? Do the Flyers have enough talent to be competitive? I've seen some early.
Heard anything on Ryan Ellis?
Not yet. And that's a big question mark for the Flyers. And, you know, I've seen all the preseason predictions. Almost everyone to this point has had them eighth in the Metro.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of Colorado, what about Georgiev? Have you your first chance to really be the starter? Like, it's different being the backup than being the starter. Maybe he's ready. His numbers were actually, when he played more frequently for Frank in New York, he was better than when, you know, Shesterkin took over. And then he was you know, playing one every 10 days or 13 days and stuff like that. So that's another one. He obviously is behind a really good defense core in Colorado. So that helps for sure. But that's another intriguing storyline for me, because as we all know, you know, we talked about Vegas's goaltending off the hop. If you don't get consistent goaltending in the NHL, it's very difficult to win for on long periods of time.
Is there any chance that Pavel Francouz is better?
I don't know. I saw people saying, yeah, look at his in the playoffs. I'm like, yeah, look at his numbers. Basically, when he played goal, they outscored the opposition. He had lots of wins, but his save percentage and everything else was terrible. So, yeah, I'm not sold to France. Like, could Francouz be – can he fill the gap for 2 to 2 weeks to a month? Yeah. Can he be your starter all year long? I'd be very surprised.
Opening night, though, you think it's Georgiev?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah. Unless he completely soils the sheets in the preseason.
And who is the opening night starter for the Vegas Golden Knights?
Now that's a good question. There's no one like Aiden Hill or Logan Thompson.
I would bet on Logan Thompson, but
yeah, probably. Yeah, he played there last year, but no, Aiden Hill. The bigger question is, can Aiden Hill still, like, it's funny. They got goalie injury issues and they went on and got a goalie who has injury issues. So, you know, that to me would be the interesting one, is how many games does Aiden Hill play before he gets hurt?
Well, Aiden Hill is amazing because he's been around for a long time, but he's only 26.
Yeah.
He's the same age as Thatcher Demko and has been in the NHL since 2017-18.
Yeah. Limited roles, of course, right? But yeah, you're right.
But it's hard to crack the league at that age, and he did it, and he's stayed in it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm fascinated. I'm pumped. I'm looking forward to it. I love the fact that, you know, preseason hockey gets going on Saturday, and then, you know, you get a few games in, then teams whittle their cuts down. Nashville and San Jose obviously will do it a lot quicker than everybody else, because they fly out on October 1st over to Europe, got the game in Germany, and then into the Czech Republic.
Are you going to go? You should go.
Yeah, I'd like to, but I've got a big event that I have on the
weekend. Pizza pig out.
Yeah.
Is that it?
My pizza pig out's on Friday the 7th, a big charity thing that we do to for kids sport, to get kids playing. And we only have about 15 slots left. It's awesome. You can go to jasongregorpizzapigout.com for anybody in the Edmonton area. If you love drive-in movies for kids, The Bad Guys is the movie
like
that's
pizza.
Playing. Seriously, Frank, this has become my favorite event, because you have these pizzerias that bring new pizza every year, and it's amazing. Some places that I'd never tried before, I hadn't even heard of some of them, and they're awesome. So I do believe I can say I'm a little bit of a pizza connoisseur now over the last 3 years, because I get to try a lot of different pizza.
Jason, as I always say, pizza is like sex. Even when it's bad, it's still really good.
100% agree, man. Like, even the worst piece of pizza, you're like, yeah, it's all right. Like,
yeah. Freezer pizza, you're like, yeah,
I like not this. Bad. Yeah. I have learned, though, Frank, I will say this. Warming up your pizza in the microwave compared to doing it either on the stove or now
in the microwave.
Well, some people warm it up because it's easy, right? Like the day after, I should say, not to cook it. Like the day after pizza.
You can't do that.
I know, but people do. But I'll tell you, have you done it in an air fryer? Game
I haven't done it in the air fryer, but I do like to just throw it on a pan on the stove.
Yeah, pan in the stove, but try an air fryer, Frank. I did that. We make homemade pizza every Friday, and I did it in the air fryer on Saturday. Game changer for reheated pizza for all of our air fryer listeners.
Good to know.
And by the way, Frank, a lot of fans on our Instagram of the lime green pants. Lots of fans of the lime green pants.
I think you're lying. I'm going to need to go and check out the
Go look at the pictures. Like, Frankie's wrong. I love it.
I showed my wife and she was like, is Jason wearing a spacesuit? What is that? Is he an astronaut?
Oh, I wish. I wish. It'd be great.
It looked like you were Frank, high as a kite.
Awesome. Good week. We'll start our previews of each division starting next Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we look forward to that.
Time is nigh.
Yeah, and we look forward to thank again to the Jets and Rick Bonus for joining us. Have yourselves a great week. We will talk Friday on the eve of preseason hockey and 2 days of training camp.
Thanks for listening to the DFO Rundown with Saravalli and Gregor. Keep it locked on dailyfaceoff.com and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from to never miss an episode. Delivered by DoorDash.
Are you ready for playoff hockey? Well, listen up, because I've got something for you. It's called the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge, and it's going to add some serious spice to your playoff experience. Now, here's the deal. Every playoff game day, you're going to be faced with four questions. It's like your own personal playoff puzzle, and here's a sneak peek into some of the questions we'll be firing your way. First up, you got to pick the winning team. Simple, right? But there's more. You gotta decide if the total for the game is going to go over or under a certain amount, and the strategy doesn't stop there. Next up, you're picking which player is going to light the lamp first, and finally, you gotta predict which period in the game is going to be the highest scoring. Will it be a barn burner in the first, a shootout in the second, or a nail biter in the third? That is all up to you. Now let's talk prizes, because who doesn't love winning stuff? Daily winners, you're getting hooked up with gift cards. That's right. Treat yourself to some nation gear or even your favorite jersey. And for the big dogs, the round winners, cash money. Cold, hard cash. We're putting real dough in your pockets simply for your hockey knowledge. So lace up those skates, stretch those thumbs, and get ready to show off your hockey IQ in the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. It's game time, folks. Head over to games.dailyfaceoff.com now and prove your puck prowess.